Trump, and a couple of weeks after Donald Trump became president, his next door neighbor at Mar-a-Lago, Bill Koch's criminal investigation suddenly stopped.
Finally, David K. Johnston, the first presidential debate is tonight. What question do you want to see raised about Donald Trump's taxes?
Oh, I think the biggest mistake Joe Biden could make would be to somehow attack wealth. That just doesn't sell in America. I think that what he should do is press him on, all right, the cat's out of the bag. You say it's fake news. Just show us your form 1040s back to the year 2000. Why don't you just put out your form 1040s? One of them's out. David K. Johnston published it 3 years ago. Just show those, and we'll see whether it's fake news or not. And Donald will dodge and parry about that. The emails I'm getting from people on the right are all designed to tell you that Joe Biden is a secret crook with a billion-dollar fortune, all of which is utter nonsense, by the way. This is a man who hadn't paid off his mortgage.
Well, David K. Johnston, I want to thank you for being with us. Pulitzer Prize-winning investigative reporter, editor of DCReport.org. His most recent book, It's Even Worse Than You Think, What the Trump Administration is Doing to America. Tonight, we will be streaming the first presidential debate live, 9 Eastern Standard Time at democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Thanks so much for joining us. Stay safe. Wear a mask.
Listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM and streaming online at kboo.fm.
This is KBOO Portland. It's 8 o'clock on a Tuesday. It's time for what we're still calling the Abe and Joe Talk Radio Show with your hosts, Abe Proctor and Tracy Simmons. Stay tuned.
Good morning. Good morning. Welcome to the Abe and Joe Talk Radio Show. I suspect it won't be the Abe and Joe Show much longer. Hopefully we'll have that situation resolved soon. I am joined this morning once again by the inimitable Tracy Simmons. Tracy, good morning.
Good morning. Good morning, listeners.
This is, of course, KBOO 90.7 FM on your radio dial on the internet tubes. If you have one of those, aim it at kboo.fm. While you're there, click on the donate button, because as you, I'm sure, understand, if you've been a long-time listener of this show, we do not depend on advertiser revenue. We do not depend on assistance from the government. We depend on support from you, our listeners, and we need it during this time of upheaval more than ever. So click on that donate button, become a member of your community radio station. And, well, Tracy, it's been what you might call a taxing week in the United States.
Yeah, all kinds.
That was low-hanging fruit. I'm sorry. That was a cheap shot.
Oh, my goodness. Yes, this New York Times article came out and dropped a bombshell that all of us knew was there. But, yes, we learned that Donald Trump paid $750 in taxes. You know, a new Gucci handbag, maybe not even. It's very interesting to kind of hear the conversations that are happening based on this revelation. You know, we're having conversations about is it tax fraud? Is it tax avoidance, which is a legal act using legal tax code regulations around deductions and credits, or is it something else? And I'm just, you know, kind of sitting back, hanging back to hear more, but I think there's more information coming for sure. And I think it's worth a note that, you know, the average American pays a lot more than $750 in taxes.
Oh, yes.
Every year. And we are held to a very different standard than other folks. And so, you know, I had to go back and look at my W-2 and kind of slapped myself when I looked at the actual amount that I have paid individually. And you know, it brings us to this point where we have to start having the conversation, you know, who's going to change this? Because we know that in a functioning society, everyone has to pay their part. But mm-hmm. the burden and the part is being paid by regular folks, middle-class folks, blue-collar workers, and the folks who have millions and billions are paying absolutely nothing. And so this is part of a larger problem, but it's also part of a character, really a look into the character of Donald J. Trump, that literally he's cheated on everything. So why wouldn't we really extrapolate that to his taxpaying, kind of history? In many years, he paid absolutely nothing. And it just brings us to the notion of how can you be a purported businessman and entrepreneur and have these kinds of losses, literally owing over $400 million. And the exposure when we think about his role and the fact that these debts are coming due very soon, we have to ask ourselves what kind of tricks he will play. To either sell off, the national secrets, the national security concerns, or just, basically do whatever he can to relieve himself of this kind of tax debt. It's just frightening to really think about the desperation that could come in just the coming months and in the coming years if this person is reelected. And it makes me very, very nervous. What say you?
Yeah, I absolutely agree with every bit of that. I'm really pleased that you mentioned the fact that this is not a phenomenon that's restricted to Donald Trump alone. There's a great many people who make a whole lot more money than you or I or most listeners to the show will ever see in their lifetime. And they spend a comparatively small amount of money in order to avoid paying a whole lot more. And it's worth mentioning that in the same years that Donald Trump paid zero income taxes, Amazon also paid zero income taxes. Google, Netflix also paid no income taxes. Obviously these are corporations and not people, although conservatives will tell you they are one and the same. This is part and parcel of a much, much larger systemic problem that has in many ways birthed the situations that we're having to endure today. Insufficient resources to combat wildfires, insufficient healthcare infrastructure to deal with the pandemic, insufficient infrastructure in general. We are a nation full of crumbling roads and bridges and dams and you name it. Insufficient public education. All of these things are a direct function of the taxation levied on a society. And, and I imagine that you and I, like many liberals, don't really mind paying our taxes because, as you mentioned, taxation is the price of civilized society. I don't mind paying my taxes because I know what we get in return. Now, living in the United States, we get a whole lot of extra garbage in return, like an enormous military monstrosity that we prop up year after year after year. But by and large, I don't have any problem with the idea of taxes. But when I see somebody like this guy, and when I see Amazon, and when I see Google, and on, paying nothing, that is a huge, huge problem. And the other thing you mentioned that I'm really pleased you mentioned is what the Times article revealed in terms of Trump's personal debt obligations. He has approaching $400 million in outstanding debt obligations coming due in the next 4 years, the 4 years of which could conceivably be spent as president of the United States. This is an astonishing thing on so many levels. First of all, how does any one person manage to get themselves nearly $400 million in debt? A lot of this debt is not guaranteed or underwritten by the Trump Organization, but by Donald Trump personally. So how does that come to pass? And second of all, I'm not very well versed in the annals of national security. I do my due diligence as a talk show host. One thing I do know is that one of the primary grounds for denying somebody a national security clearance in the United States is a large amount of outstanding personal debt. Because quite sensibly, the national security establishment views outstanding debt as a lever. If you owe a lot of money, that means you have a weakness that someone can exploit, to learn national security secrets of the United States. So one can only imagine
what the president of the United States, who owes close to $400 million, that's nine digits, Scott, nine digits. What, you know, who, any number of people can lean on him. I would put Vladimir Putin at the very top of that list. And this also, you know, we haven't learned the complete picture of Donald Trump's finances, but this article suggests some missing pieces in the overall story of his financial life. One of those big questions, one of the big missing pieces is, what exactly does Putin have on Trump? And if you consider how destitute he was before The Apprentice came along, you have to wonder, you know, what sort of things might Putin have dangled in front of him? Was this mythical $300 Moscow Trump Tower deal dangled out there? Was that how Putin got his hooks into Trump? Did he get his hooks in by leveraging some other part of this massive debt? We don't know, but we have a clearer picture than we did before.
And I guess that's exactly the question I want to know. Who do you owe this money to? Because right. Those are the people who are going to pull the strings on the puppet, right? And mm-hmm. And it's really, really scary that we still don't know that. Who do you owe the money to? Because that gets us an inroads into explaining some of the behaviors we've seen over the past 3.5 plus 4 years, with, you know, just not willing to hold Russia accountable for any of their bad dealings, for cozying up to MBS or Erdogan or some of these other mm-hmm. Dictator-like personas out in the political sphere of the world. Whether we're talking Filipino President Duterte, I think there's a revelation that some of the money is from the Philippines. And so we just have to really be savvy with doing the financial, you know, investigation that's going to come from this. But what's interesting, when I saw Trump's body language yesterday as he was having a quick conversation with the press, is he looked like Eeyore. He looked like a man kind of just sunken down, and even the posture of his body, it looked different.
I'm the president.
Yeah,
it's a hard day for me.
It really was. And, you know, he's a perpetual victim anyway.
Right.
But literally what his camp is saying, that this is a hit job on him. And what I say is, it's a hit job, and you have evidence that this is not true. Why wouldn't you provide that evidence, right? We want to see the documents. We'll trust you if you have documents to show otherwise. But it's not a political hit job if it's true. It's just true. And so, you know, we have to, like, really think about the logic behind that, because everything set up to see Donald Trump as a victim allows us to kind of just disregard, you know, all of the facts and truth. And, you know, someone else said, you know, his supporters are not going to change their minds on this. They think it's smart to not pay taxes. And I'm going to push back and say that the blue-collar people that support Donald Trump are either fully in it for the racism, because there's not much else to glom on to, or they are going to be turned off by the fact that they pay taxes. You know, I get a paycheck, and guess what? I don't even see most of it, because many of the dollars that I'm paid go to those taxes. I am absolutely not complaining about that. I support the tax base. I support the public interest. Yet, I can't imagine that supporters who are not supporters before the race are going to feel really good about this. And I think it's something we all knew, but having the evidence makes it a little bit different.
You're right. I think you're asking what does his insoluble, irreducible, 30 to 40% of the electorate, you know, what are they glomming onto? And I think you're absolutely right. It's the racism. This man is a fraud. Every aspect of his life is fraudulent. He was a terrible businessman. He inherited close to $500 million from his dad, managed to burn through all of it. The Times article makes clear they got a hold of his tax records from 1985 to 1994. And during several of those years, he lost more money than any other American taxpayer. And in the early 90s, one year, posted a loss of close to $1 billion for that fiscal year alone. It was such a loss of such magnitude, that he was able to use that loss to indemnify himself against tax obligations for the next several years. But even still, he burned through that 900 and something million dollar cushion faster than anybody would have thought, to the point that when The Apprentice came along with NBC, you know, he was nearly skint. This was what came along and revived his fortunes. And it suggests, because he ended up earning, over the course of time The Apprentice was on the air, almost another $500 million, it suggests that as that money was once again running out, that he ran for president, hoping that the celebrity he had amassed during his time on The Apprentice would project him once more into the limelight. I don't think that he ever expected to actually win. I think that he ran hoping to cash in one more time and found some sort of media network after he had dropped out of the presidential race. Unfortunately for the world, he won that presidential race. And here we are.
Yes, yeah, absolutely. So, you know, I was really thinking about, like, okay, what, and I think this is where we're at in kind of this cycle that we're in with Donald Trump, that there really aren't any historical corollaries to this behavior. But, you know, looking back, Nixon did fail to pay a full tax sum. And in 1970s, he paid $792 in taxes, which is still even more than Donald Trump. And this was in the middle of Nixon's impeachment. And, of course, the public, you know, perception and support for Nixon sharply dropped off when he was revealed to also be a tax cheater. He had to eventually pay back the numerous years of back taxes and was held accountable for that. But, you know, there really aren't parallels to the times that we're in. And so it's just really interesting thinking about, well, what do we do going forward? We have to absolutely revise the tax code. You know, in Trump's first year in office, 2016, he and the Republicans passed that huge continuing to diminish the tax responsibilities of very rich people in the United States. And, you know, I just have to think that has to be repealed and the tax code needs to be revised. I mean, at this point, I would be okay with a flat tax. It still doesn't make a ton of sense, but it makes more sense than very, very rich, wealthy people, especially people who purport themselves to love America, not really wanting to pay into a functioning society. And so, you know, it's like, I'm always thinking of how to undo what has been done. It's a huge mess. It's been happening. I think, you know, even you and I have talked about, you know, this is 40 years of work that will have to be undone, because this is what's been kind of this trickle-down economics, and it's just been building upon that since the 80s. But we as citizens need to vote out people who are not thinking about the public interest and who are not really thinking and considering how regular people experience the world with way less money and way more tax burden. It just doesn't make sense, and it sets us up to have a society where we have billionaires and houseless people in the same society, and it makes no sense because those billionaires, other than Donald Trump, are never going to be able to spend that level of money. I also want to talk about that huge reporting of losses. That is the number one way to launder money. And so we have to think about who is laundering money and whose money is being laundered. Because I think there's a connection there for sure that needs to be also really deeply investigated and looked into.
Yeah, trickle-down economics. Something's trickling down, but it ain't money.
Yeah.
you talked about how do we undo this damage. That is a huge question, because as you mentioned, this is at least a 40-year project in American governance, even longer if you look back to the recalibration of the GOP that happened in the wake of Barry Goldwater's loss back in the 60s. I mean, this is a huge problem. We talk many times on the show and in progressive circles, the topic of income inequality and concentration of wealth you know, these are huge issues affecting quality of life for literally hundreds of millions of people in the United States. And we need to start viewing these in the stark terms that exist. The concentration of wealth in the United States now surpasses levels from the early industrial age, the robber baron era of the late 1800s and early 1900s. We have surpassed that level of income inequality. And frankly, we are approaching pre-French Revolution level. I think you can, even a casual student of history, you know, that should make your hair stand up. It's a huge problem, and it's going to take a lot. It's going to take a lot to undo it. It's going to take something like the pre- and post-war liberal consensus that arose after the Great Depression. Actually, even before the Great Depression, it arose to counteract the concentration of wealth of the Gilded Age that we were just talking about. It's going to take a massive phase change in American political and economic thought. There is some hope, I glean these days, looking around, hearing some of the things that major political figures are saying in public and on the campaign trail. This article in the New York Times, frankly, underscores every point that Bernie Sanders ever made as a presidential candidate. Mm-hmm. So the seeds of reversing this are there. Of course, there are so many obstacles, one of which is just the irreducible mindset of that, you know, 35 to 40% that supports Trump. Another big obstacle is the fact that the courts now have been systematically packed with conservative justices for many years. And we're looking at, inevitably, a 6-3 conservative majority on the Supreme Court. So it's a big, big hole that we as a culture and as a society need to dig ourselves out of. And unfortunately, it's probably going to define American life for a couple of generations. It's really, the rot has become that widespread. So let's go to, well, I don't think we're quite ready to go to the phones, but we should announce the number. 503-231-8187 is the number to call. This is a Joe Talk radio program on KBOO 90.7 FM. I'm here with Tracy Simmons. Tracy, let's talk about that Supreme Court nomination. Are you at all surprised that Mitch McConnell broke his own rule and agreed to hold a vote on Trump's nominee?
Absolutely not. You know, people who are just that, you know, kind of devious to maintain power will maintain power in whatever way that they can. I do feel like, and I felt like this for a while, that the Republican Party, as far as their actual policies, are becoming less and less attractive for American people, for the majority of American people. And so holding on to power by any means necessary is going to be a tactic that we will continue to see, as long as these people are continually voted in. And so, you know, Mitch McConnell, I you know, people are like, oh, the hypocrisy. Well, you know, that only works with people with really strong characters and integrity. That's not a marker of anything for someone who has no scruples, who will do whatever to maintain power. And so I think, you know, as we see this kind of movement towards pushing through a nominee, and a very, very problematic, for me at least, nominee, we're going to see these things continue to happen. And using the argument of, you know, you didn't even stick to your own word, is not going to work. This is not what we're dealing with. And I think, you know, when we think about the ways in which, you know, kind of Democratic candidates and people who believe strongly in Democratic principles will, you know, want to prop up someone as a person with high integrity, a party with high integrity, you know, we will literally skewer our own folks because, you know, something's wrong. We've got these kind of purist policies or single voter policies that it's like, you know, we're not going to have this person in our no, the Republicans have full on launched themselves into Trumpism, and now Republicanism is Trumpism, and they're going to ride this horse till it you know, just kind of collapses. And so I am not at all surprised. I am of course saddened, and of course hoping that the only recourse is to, you know, continue expanding the court and to nullify this process. But, you know, as we see these nominees, they're younger and younger, and they will have an impact on American life for generations. And they're also not in line with what Americans want. And so this is really interesting. You know, we've got so many things on the line with this coming election, and the potential for, in the way that Trump has done it in the past, talk to somebody and ask them to resign for the court so you can nominate another Supreme Court justice. Frightening. It's frightening the potential that there is in the next 4 years if this continues. And so we're just on the precipice of what I feel like is just a critical moment. You know, here in Oregon, we can only vote by mail. I'm trying to encourage people I know in other places that if they have the ability to vote in person, please vote in person. Because the last thing we want is on election night for there to be any question about who won. You know, we look at the polls. Well, we looked at the polls in 2016, and they all were pointing towards Hillary Clinton. There are so many, you know, things that we don't know that are happening in the background, and it could all be tied to that. You know, who is Trump owing to? Who is he holding to? And who is going to prop him up to continue him, you know, having power? We have to really be very, very decisive in our action, commit to that action. And I won't say that we throw scruples out the window, but that we become ruthless, right? Senator Ginsburg has left us. Let's be a little more ruthless in our proposition for America and obtaining that proposition for our future.
Yeah, I completely agree. It's absolutely time to be ruthless. I stumbled upon a friend on social media last night who put up some very helpful suggestions for what Democrats in Congress might do if they had either a backbone or savvy. So I'm really doubtful if they'll actually do these things. But here's just a few of them, and they make a lot of sense. Don't show up for the hearings. There's no reason to dignify this raw exercise in political hypocrisy. Don't legitimize the theft of the Supreme Court with your presence. And that would be a spectacle. The time the Supreme Court justice was... the hearings were held and a vote was held and none of the opposition party showed up. And then, you know, if they decide to show up to the hearings, which they probably will, they don't ask any of her views on future cases because they're hypothetical. So they should not bother to ask those hypothetical questions. And in any event, if they did, she would probably dodge them anyway. And they should not even mention her religion. Instead, they should ask questions like this. Judge Barrett, would you please explain the emoluments clause to the Constitution? Judge Barrett, if a president were to refuse to divest himself of his properties and, in fact, continue to steer millions of dollars in taxpayer money to his properties, would this violate the emoluments clause? And then just go down every single illegal act that Trump has carried out in public since he's held office. Violations of the Hatch Act, to Congress's failure to exercise oversight on the president, to Trump's impeachment, and just make every single question about the man who is nominating her rather than her controversial religious stances on women's bodily autonomy, rather than any of that, rather than any attempt to exact a hypothetical answer to how she might rule on a future hypothetical case. Just make it all about this moment in time and the man and the track record that has put her in that chair in front of Congress. I think that's a really good way to approach this. Which again leads me to believe that it's probably not going to happen.
I'm guessing it's not either. And, you know, I actually like the political clause. Like, don't even ask questions. This is fully illegitimate. You have violated your own rules, the rules in which you came up with. And I just remember, you know, my late amazing father would say things like, you know, the Republicans play dirty. They change the rules when they're losing. And it's been borne out, you know, in, you know, as long as I've been alive and paying attention to politics, that is absolutely true. And so at some point, our actual people who have the power to vote them out must do so, right? These are not people of integrity. These are not people who are caring at all about your best interest as a human. I think about, you know, the people who are served by Mitch McConnell in the state, right? What does he ever do for them? I don't know. I mean, I guess maybe that they're excited about the things that he's doing in the Senate, but not possibly be doing anything for them because he's got a stack of bills that have never been even brought for a vote that have their best interests, right? Like, so right. It's inconceivable that these people will continue voting for people who have expressed in every way possible that they care nothing about their constituents and care only about maintaining, holding on to power, and increasing their own wealth and influence in the world. And so it's like, when are our voting blocs going to come together and stand up for the common good of society? I'm always thinking about that. Of course, you know, we'll see what happens. But
it's the racism. That's why they're voting. We've got some callers standing by. Let's go to them right now. If you'd like to join the conversation, 503-231-8187 is the number to call. Karen, good morning.
Good morning. Gosh, you brought so many topics up since I called in, but I'm going to stick with my original point, which is that I think one of the most important things that we have to do is we have to go back to basics. Where does the money come from? And the money comes because people do work. And so to say that people have to be responsible who have a lot of money really is not on point from my point of view. From my point of view, it's about what is just, what is fair. Workers should have a much bigger say in production, in the conditions of production, in the way that they are compensated, and mm-hmm. that it's the capitalist system is a really toxic sick system. And we first have to regulate the bejeebers out of it, but we also have to reconstitute our economy. And it has to be done democratically, and that's why it's such a difficult process. But it's utterly unfair. Workers, when I think of immigrant laborers in the fields in California working in the smoke with no PPE, how workers were treated going back into the meatpacking plants, why COVID has escalated like it has amongst African Americans and amongst people of color. It's all part of the oppression, the economic oppression. And I mean, as well as inequalities in health care and education and et cetera, the systemic racism. But that's my main point, is that we have to stop thinking about, oh, they have to be nice and they have to be responsible. No, this is what they owe. This is what they owe. They owe a just wage. They owe. The workers have the right because they're making the money ultimately. And so I feel very passionate about that. Sorry, I'm losing it a little bit. So that's one point. That's my main point. The other question I have, if we ever can get to it, is I don't clearly understand the money laundering and why Deutsche Bank gives loans to people like Trump and why Eric Trump says, well, you know, we get all of our money from Russia. When money's dirty, in my mind, it comes from illegal drugs. It comes from illegal arms deals. It comes from prostitution. It comes from that kind of thing. I don't know what's illegal in Russia, and I don't really get that part. So that's my comment. That's my main comment. The main comment is working class consciousness. The secondary question has to do with dark money and why they would bother to loan anything to Trump, the money laundering business. And thank you so much. I'm so glad that the two of you are on. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you very much for the question. I appreciate it. With regard to workers, you're absolutely right. I'm a believer that the ultimate source of all wealth is labor, right? Capitalists will have you believe that they are the job creators because they have enough money already to get an operation up and running. And as the controllers of capital, they are the bosses. Well, you know, that smacks to me like a modern version of the divine right of kings. That's nonsense. Wealth derives from the labor of human beings. And I think it should be wealth earned through labor should be privileged above wealth earned through ownership or through passive means. And what do I mean by that? First of all, that workers should earn a better than living wage. There should be no poverty in the world's most wealthy country. And in addition to earning a good wage, workers should pay a smaller percentage of their income in taxation because wealth is earned with the work of their bodies or the work of their minds,
And so that wealth should be taxed at a lower rate than, you know, somebody's capital gains because they're invested in a hedge fund, for example. That's how we value labor. That's something we used to do in this country, probably not to the extent we should have, but we did it for a while, and we did it better than anybody else. But that hasn't been the case for a long, long time. Now, switching over to the second part of your question about dirty money and what is it. You're wondering what exactly is illegal in Russia, and did this money that came from Russia and made its way into the Trump family coffers, you know, is it dirty or was it illegal? I think in the final analysis, that's kind of immaterial. We know what ethical sources of revenue are and what non-ethical sources of revenue are. Whether or not those things are illegal in Russia is beside the point. We know, and anybody purporting to lead this free republic should be keeping their hands off dirty money, regardless of where it comes from. That's how I feel about that.
The source of many of those illegal funding streams are racketeering. So protection money to support the business, protection money that you're paying to the Russian government to be able to support. There's various forms, but it's typically from a racketeering type organization, which unfortunately right now the Russian government is a racketeering type organization.
Yeah, it's more or less a kleptocracy in Russia, as I understand it.
Absolutely.
All right, let's go to Mick. Good morning.
Hey, nice to talk to you guys. I'm down here in Trump country in Yamhill County. A couple of points I want to make. First of all, about 6 weeks ago, there was an excellent article in the New Yorker about Mitch McConnell and how vacuous he is. He has no discernible political philosophy other than staying in power. He has made decisions that have benefited his wife's businesses, which are in Korea. His wife is Secretary of Commerce, I believe, Elaine Chao. My second point is that if I can remember my civics lessons correctly, there is nothing in the Constitution that says how many Supreme Court justices there should be. I think we started out with 5, went to 7, now we're at 9. There's nothing preventing Biden to appoint 2 more justices to the Supreme Court. And those are my comments. Thanks a lot for listening. I'll start my tractor again and get back to doing what I'm doing in the agricultural area here in Yamhill County. Thanks.
Yeah, keep up the good work. Thank you for the call. Yeah, there's nothing in the Constitution that limits the number of Supreme Court justices to 9. Now, that said, in a vacuum, inflating the number of justices, is a pretty bald-faced political move. But I think in this context, it's really the only thing that's progressive, one of the only tools available to us now to avoid what amounts to a decades-long veto in the Supreme Court. And now, I know a lot of you listening to this program don't like it when I conflate the progressive causes with the Democratic Party. I know you don't like that very much. Frankly, I'm not entirely comfortable with it either. But I'll say again what I said many times on this program. Whatever their flaws, the Democratic Party in Congress must be our instrument because we don't have anyone else. If we want a third-party representation in Congress, we will need, as a society, to collectively vote them in. I think that is many years away at this point. So we got to work with what we got. And that means right now, if there's a Joe Biden victory, increasing the number of justices on the court from 9 to 11. Tracy, you want to weigh in on that before we go back to the phones?
I would just say that we don't have many other options. What will happen is if we have a far-right Supreme Court and even the presidency, the Senate, and Congress, we will not be able to move anything forward because guess what? The people who have money will file lawsuits. Those lawsuits will get caught up in the courts, and they will ultimately reach the Supreme Court, who will strike down whatever it is, whether that's the ACA, whether that's pushing forward with a legal mandate on abortion that's not in the courts, whatever it is, any progressive ideas that come forward that get passed by both the House of Representatives and the Senate and get signed off on by the President, if we have all houses, it will not go forward in a very right Supreme Court. So that's the only way that we're going to move this country to progress and through this next, five to 10 years.
Yeah. And let's not lose track of the math here either. Even if the Supreme Court is successfully expanded to 11 justices, there would still be a 6-5 conservative majority on the court.
Yep.
Yeah, that's how skewed things have become. All right, let's go to Francis. Good morning.
Hi. Your last caller kind of touched one of my points about the fact that this reality TV president could not exist without the complicit support of the corporate surrogates in the Republican majority, including Mitch McConnell. That is where our checks and balances are supposed to be, and it's non-existent there. Now, the Supreme Court, I know everyone's concerned about Ms. Barrett, and I did some research on her, and she's a what they call an originalist. She believes in the letter of the law and reads the Constitution as it's written. And I found some interesting cases. You know, the Supreme Court, Justice Warren, Earl Warren, was supposed to be a conservative, they say. But it was the Warren Court that in which some very landmark civil rights cases were. The Warren Court is now considered to be liberal, although he was appointed as a conservative. And Justice Roberts has made some opinions recently that would be sided with the quote-unquote liberal side of the court. So I'm thinking if the argument is presented right, there's no way to deny it for people that are legitimate judges who won't deny the logic or the facts presented to them. But anyway, Barrett, I read a couple of her opinions. One was a dissenting opinion in a case where someone had reported that people were playing around with guns at this location. The police responded, and nobody was playing around with guns. However, the police still searched the people's car and found a gun, and the person who owned the car was charged with illegal possession of a firearm. And her opinion was that the police should have responded to the call, and when they found that there was no gunplay going on, that should have been the end of it. And that the person should not have been searched, his car should not have been searched. And I thought, well, that's interesting. That is correct to me. That's the right thing. And for people who have, you know, rights against the police, her, I believe it was a dissenting opinion, was actually correct as far as I was concerned. And another case where someone was arrested for illegal possession of a firearm. She, and I think the court agreed with her on this one, she said that because he had a felony, right, he shouldn't have a firearm. And people are saying that means she's pro the Second Amendment. But what she said was that this person had a felony, a fraud felony. It was a nonviolent crime. And there should be no reason why that crime should prevent him from possessing a firearm just like everyone else. And I tend to agree with that also. So my point is RBG, the notorious RBG, presented her cases before conservative courts, and she won because her argument was so compelling, there was no way they could deny it. So there's still hope that logic will prevail, but I know it's going to be a difficult time. There's a lot of work to do, but that's what we're here for, I guess. Anyway, I enjoyed hearing Joan's song this morning. At least you're still playing the My Favorite Things by Coltrane. That was his song from the beginning, and I hope that one day his fans get to hear what's up with him. But you guys take care, and I appreciate you a lot.
Hey, thank you, Francis. Thank you. Appreciate the call, as usual. I think the big concern amongst progressives about Amy Coney Barrett is that when presented with the opportunity to overturn Roe versus Wade, she would elect to do that. I think it's really about bodily autonomy of more than half of the American population.
And I think that she would also take that same step to repeal the Affordable Care Act as well. Mm-hmm. And in the middle of a pandemic, I have so many concerns about the potential for millions of Americans to be without health care. It's unconscionable for me.
And we probably shouldn't forget that Trump, in accordance with his tendency to say the quiet part out loud, publicly stated that Judge Barrett needed to be seated quickly just in case she needs to rule on the outcome of the election.
Mm-hmm.
So let's not forget about that. Let's go to Robbie. Robbie, good morning.
Good morning. I wanted to bring up some stuff about the taxes. There's a lot of stuff that you're covering. It's really good. The thing with Trump and the taxes is actually quite scary, because what I see is they've now backed him up against the wall. They've backed him up against the wall. He's going to be going to jail if he doesn't win this election. So he's going to be doing, you know, anything to maintain that power to not go to jail. Which is, I mean, you know, granted, we all kind of knew what was happening, but I think you brought up very interesting points that a lot of people, I mean, when we take a look at the news, there are so many things that Democrats can do to stop the Supreme Court. You know, they don't, it doesn't even take a constitutional lawyer to understand, if they don't participate in that voting, that will prolong it until after the election anyway. So the fact that the Democrats are trying to, you know, urge us to call senators to urge them not to vote is pointless, because all it takes is two or one Democrat senator to not participate, and then that's going to prolong it. So I don't, and it's weird. There's weird stuff like this constantly. And I guess I'll say one more point, but that's, we were saying earlier, you know, oh, money comes from workers. Actually, I disagree with that statement. The money comes from the Federal Reserve. The Federal Reserve prints money in the form of debt. Which then it controls the debt by, it controls the economy and the money and the inflation of the dollar by the housing industry. And it does housing practices, which is exactly how Russia prints their money and the oligarchs that control that. So if you follow the money, you know, I think we would be questioning why we pay taxes for the war machine when literally our own country is printing money out of thin air. I don't understand that, but it's just some points I had, I guess.
Hey, well, thanks for the call. Appreciate your comments. It's my understanding that procedural delays on the part of the Democrats in Congress will ultimately be fruitless, because McConnell could force a vote if he needs to. That's my understanding of it. I could very well be wrong on that point. And to Robbie's last point about the Federal Reserve being the source of money, when I said that labor was the ultimate source of wealth, that's what I mean, wealth. Even before there was money, before there was even an agricultural economy, you know, wealth derived from the labor of people's bodies and minds. That's what I mean. And we undervalue the contribution of labor in this country. And that tension between owners and workers has been part of our economic story from the get-go. And that has only become magnified since the Industrial Revolution happened almost 200 years ago now. So we need to put workers back to their rightful place in the economic hierarchy, not to make them rich, but to ensure that everybody who works an honest day's labor can live a decent life and educate their children and maybe have enough to go to the beach for a week every year. You know what I mean? That's what I'm talking about. It's not a lot, you know, but there it is. We have George standing by, but before we go to George, Tracy, there's one more thing I wanted to bring up today, and that is the great non-rally held by the Proud Boys at Delta Park over the weekend. Setting aside just the tastelessness of holding a rally on the site of the former city of Vanport, if we just put that aside for now, it was about as underwhelming a gathering as you could possibly imagine. They had applied for a permit for 20,000 people. That was 10,000 demonstrators, 10,000 counter demonstrators, That permit application was denied by the Portland Parks Bureau, and what ended up happening Saturday at Delta Park was a really dumb-looking gathering of 200 or 300 people.
Yeah, yeah. Oh, at least they got their picnic. I mean, I don't know. I my whole thoughts about the Proud Boys and Patriot Prayer and some of these groups coming into Portland is like, let's starve them of the oxygen, right? Let's not show up. Let's not go fight with them. Let's just act like we don't really care, and give them no attention, because attention is what they seek. And I was really, really proud of my city in the fact that people did not show up there. There was a counter protest in Peninsula Park and in Alberta Park that were largely peaceful. And, you know, it was like, you know, this is the anarchist rally, come for the soup. It was cute. It was fun. But what's interesting is that there were no fights between the Proud Boys and the protesters, who were in separate places in the city. But what happened at night when protesters came out to protest and march through the city, they were beaten up by the Portland police. So
yes, they were. Yeah. Who have been deputized as federal agents.
Oh,
yes.
My goodness. Boy, oh boy. Ted Wheeler. I don't even
know
about that. But,
indeed.
Yeah, an interesting time for sure. But I was really proud that there was, you know, no violence between these two groups. There's potential for that every time, and it gives me pause, and it makes my tummy hurt because I am, you know, not into that. And I just wonder, you know, what are you proud of? What are the Proud Boys proud of? I always question what they are there to demonstrate, what they support. If they are anti-fascist, that means that they are fascist. I wonder, and I don't know anybody in the group. So if we have callers who are, I would love to just kind of wax poetic about, you know, what is it?
Well, I don't know. I mean, some of their accessorizing was really on point. I saw some Confederate flag bandanas that were really popping. I mean, they should be proud of their fashion sense, really. And their trucks. Their trucks were burnished to a high gloss. I would be proud. All right, let's go to George. George, good morning.
Good morning, Abe and co-host. I wanted to address very briefly the co-host
Tracy.
Remark.
Her name's Tracy.
Excuse me, please? The co-host wanted to say something? No. Okay.
Oh, go ahead.
Okay. What I wanted to say, if I may, was the co-host mentioned, I can't remember the co-host's name, but I'm 86, but she mentioned that there are no historical parallels for what's happening. I would suggest, if she or you would care to look at it, a book by a British Brigadier General J.H. Morgan, who was really a secret agent for the British government from about 1900 on through the end of World War II, and who found out that Hitler was one of a number of candidates to distract the public from the domination by great industrial firms like Krupp and Thyssen and others, so that the German people could be, diverted from their interest in real democracy to supporting a phony democracy under Hitler and invading Russia. That's all I have. The book is called A Size of Arms by Brigadier General J.H. Morgan. Okay, that's it.
Hey, bye. Thanks, George. Yeah, your book recommendations are always fascinating, and I've never seemed to have enough time to get to them. I would offer that you know, the information ecosystem personified by Fox News and propagated by all of its anchors and by its puppet members of Congress does exactly that. It distracts people from the real business of democracy. When I hear people like the Proud Boys and like Patriot Prayer talking about freedom, what comes through to me time and again is that these people really have no conception of what freedom actually means and no grasp of the responsibilities that come with exercising freedom. It's all about what I can do for me whenever I want. And if you tell me I can't, well, you're stepping on my freedom. So I think George might be really onto something there.
Yeah, I'm fascinated. I would love to read that. I think I was really referring to in American history that I am not aware of a presidential figure in the history of America that is like Trump, is as not smart, is as corrupt in every way. I mean, even if you think about the corruption of Ulysses S. Grant. And the corruption of presidents during the time of Robert Barron, it's nothing. It's just nothing compared to Trump as a figure, as a figurehead, as a public figure, as an entertainer, as a terrible representation of you know what we would like to see as kind of the American persona, right? No integrity. Has cheated on everything from wives to his taxes to, you know, his business reporting, has failed in every business. At this point, you know, we're at about 14% unemployment in the United States. We have crept over 200,000 Americans have died. This is what I'm talking about. There's not a parallel in American history to a president that is anything like what we're seeing right now. So I appreciate that, George, and I definitely will take a peek at the book. I also worry about, you know, the parallels and the way in which we kind of, you know, do a little look at Trump through the Hitler lens for people who don't see Trump as so terrible. It creates a dissonance that allows them to say, well, he's not that bad. but if you think about, you know, forced sterilizations at the border, children in cages, family separations, the policies of, you know, using racial grievances to amass power, I would say that there is definitely a corollary there, for sure.
Yeah, you know, and I put that question to conservative friends and family. Like, you know, why do you like this guy so much when he's so manifestly unfit for the job? You know, and I'll tick off all these different reasons like you just did. And the answer that I keep getting, more or less, is I like him because he puts America first. I mean, well, there's a statement just begging to be unpacked. What does that mean? Puts America first. Who are you talking about? Are you talking about all Americans? Clearly you're not. Are you talking about, you know, the economic health of all Americans? Clearly you're not. Are you talking about the right of Americans to breathe clean air and drink clean water? Clearly you're not. So, you know, what does that mean to put America first? What sort of outmoded, outdated, and frankly racist conception of America are you clinging to if you look to this guy and believe that he is putting the interests of his country above those of himself and his family? You're either dumb or you're willfully ignorant at that point. You know, and for those of you out there wondering if I just called you dumb, you might want to reflect on that a little bit. My mom is going to really scold me for saying that, but that's okay. So as we're winding down here, Tracy, what are you looking for in tonight's presidential debate?
Well, I'm looking for strategy. I want to see a calm and collected Joe Biden stick to the facts. I just need some of those facts. You know, what's up with the taxes? Who do you owe? How much do you owe? Why have none of your businesses ever been shown as the data that we can see to be successful? Why are we still at a no national strategy for COVID-19 pandemic when we are an uptick? You know, Oregon last week reported the highest single day number of cases.
Yes.
And so it's upticking across the country. Why is there no national strategy when we have surpassed 200,000 Americans dead? You know, what are we doing with regard to getting people back to work? Where is the stimulus coming from? Why aren't you pressuring the Senate and the House of Representatives to come up with something as far as a stimulus package to help everyday Americans get through this pandemic? Those who are, you know, needing health care, why are we stripping people of health care right now and doing everything we can to make sure that the ACA goes away? I think I would love to see him really stick to the facts, to be articulate in stating those facts, And in asking questions, right? That he uses his time not only to, you know, kind of attack his opponent, but also end on a question. I am a practitioner of Fran Seeley's strategic questioning, and asking questions that lead person to either not be able to answer or lead the audience to fill in the blank is how he's going to really start to compel any, and I have questions about this, undecided voters. Right? What are you undecided about? What more do you need to know about these two people? Because they could not be any more different. And I think also, you know, Joe Biden needs to present himself as a different alternative, the better and more savvy and capable person to do this job at this time in our history. So that's what I'm looking for.
Yeah, I'm looking for exactly the same thing. And you're right. Those sort of questions that leave him dissembling and spinning, those are the kind of questions we need to hear. And I also want to hear a question about the $70,000 haircut line item in Trump's taxes. I want to know, how many haircuts does that represent? You know, is that just a handful of haircuts, or are the haircuts amortized over a period of years? This is what I want to know.
I just want to know, well, why does his hair still look like that? If you're getting that much, yeah. And that's what you're getting rocked.
Yeah, either you're underpaying, or you just don't have anything to work with then. What is it? So I want to thank everybody who called up to participate in the show today. We appreciate your input, as always. If you're not a member of KBOO, now's a great time to become one. Go to kboo.fm, click on the donate button, become a member of this station. Tune into the debate tonight, and we will be back at you next week. Thank you, Tracy.
Thanks, Abe. Bye, listeners.
Bye, everybody.
KBOO Community Radio is hiring a program director to manage our programming department. This full-time position requires proven experience in program directing, radio audio production, management, and supervisory skills with volunteers, with an emphasis on teamwork and a collaborative setting, and the